news from campers matters to you.
And me.
And me.
And me.
And us.
So, weekdays at 5pm, URN brings you The Pulse. 1 hour of news stories that matter to you.
And me.
And me.
And
I think they get the point. The Pulse. Weekdays from 5.
Because the BBC don't care about the beer prices in Mooch.
So the High Court has recently ruled against the government over its failure to tackle illegal air pollution. The organisation Client Earth undertook a judicial review action in challenging the effectiveness of a particular aspect of current environmental policy. It was held that the government knowingly relied on optimistic vehicle emissions tests, which is in itself an echo of the recent revelations against Volkswagen, and ignored higher, more realistic figures in order to delay action by up to a decade. So some low emission zones in urban areas were actually put off until about 2020 or 2025. The onus is now on the government in order to rectify the situation and bring the UK back in line with environmental obligations. And this story is particularly pertinent given the date. I'm not sure if you guys know this, but in a couple of days, the 2015 Paris Agreement, one of the, like, an absolutely monumental step in combating climate change, that comes into force in 2 days. Followed shortly after by the 22nd Conference of the Parties, which is the global climate change meeting. Now, this isn't a particularly controversial topic. I doubt any of us will complain now that the government's been told to care more about the environment. But there's actually the second time they've come out with a plan like this. The first one was shot down in the same way by the same organisation. I just want to know, do you guys think the government will actually do anything about this?
I mean, if it's happened twice, they need to rethink their plan, really, don't they? I don't understand why they aren't working with more teams and the organisation that keeps stopping them to make a plan that is going to benefit the environment. I mean, we are not the best country for combating air pollution at all. There's a lot more countries, a lot more other countries that have done so much better a model. I don't understand why we're not looking at their way of combating air pollution and following that. I mean, I feel like it's just, you know.
Well, a lot of different countries, you know, they've got different situations,
yeah,
different contexts. But I think, at least in those countries, they're trying, and at least we should be trying.
Exactly.
I think what's very telling about this case is that our government didn't try. They knew that there was something wrong. They knew that the figures were off, and they knew that they weren't sufficient. And yet they still went ahead with the plan, which is just, I mean, we've had I can't remember the exact statistic, but recently there was quite a stunning revelation that we crossed a threshold for global CO2 saturation in the air. I can't remember the exact, it was something like 400 parts per million or something, or 40 parts per million. But that's the threshold we're not going to come back over. That's like once in a several generations, if not hundreds of years kind of thing. So we're well into our fight against climate change. And the fact that there are still states not doing this and not putting all the effort in, I think that's absolutely reprehensible.
It is quite scary that we don't see this as something that needs to be done straight away. It actually scares me. I mean, it's the previous generation, well, that's what they tell you, it's the previous generation that has made it so bad, and we're just adding to it, and nothing seems to be slowing down, as far as I've heard about figures and stuff.
I mean, the trouble is with environmentalism and, like, the environment politically is that it's not something that ever appears on a to-do list for a government. Nor, I mean, there are evidently lots of people who are very angry about what the environmental policy is, or what is actually the practicalities of what actually happens in terms of environmental policy. But there always seems to be something that is more important. And okay, the economy is important, health is important, education is important, but it never seems, especially outside of an election cycle, and even in an election cycle, it seems environmental issues always take second precedence, because they don't seem to happen in this country, even though in reality they really are.
I think it's interesting you mention that, because obviously we don't necessarily experience the same amount of environmental devastation or impact that some small Pacific Island states do, which are already crossed the threshold for flooding from the sea, rising sea levels in the future. But on the article I read, it actually did say that in the UK, 40,000 people die due to air pollution.
That's scary.
It is very scary. And there's just the fact that, again, that the government's not complying with obligations. And I mentioned the Paris Agreement, and one of the unfortunate criticisms about the Paris Agreement is that it doesn't actually have a substantial base of binding legal obligations. That was part, if I'm not sure if any of you guys know much about climate change and the various international actions against it, but the previous Kyoto Agreement was completely undermined by various states, being the USA, not agreeing with some of its binding obligations. And that's part of the reason why this new agreement has kind of been declawed. But if that doesn't have binding legal obligations, and we're already showing that our government isn't trustworthy in response to what's obviously killing so many people and is obviously a massive effect for the entire world, it's not just us. I really don't think that bodes well for the future.
No, especially with especially with developing countries as well wanting to use more fossil fuels and everything to get to the point where we are at. I don't see why we should turn around and say, "Oh no, you can't do that," because we've already done it. But to balance that out, we need to decrease completely, and I don't understand why the government aren't seeing that.
I mean, for me, these sorts of big environmental conferences, obviously they're important. It's obvious that we need to do more to talk as a society of nations to resolve the problem, which is a global problem, together. But to me, every time it seems to happen, we get told, oh, it's this monumental agreement, but it all just seems like it's PR to say, well, we've agreed this. This is a good idea. We're going to try and enact this across the world. But then every single government that's taking part in these protocols, in these agreements, have to ratify it with their own parliament, which are going to have different views, different priorities, different outlooks on what is dangerous and what is safe, what is worth risking, what isn't. So it scares me how many decisions have to be taken by so many different parties just to try and move in one direction. It seems like it's an impossible task when I look at it like that.
Which is kind of why the reason that the next week, like literally from now on until the next 7 days, is very important for climate change in the future. So you mentioned all the different parties having to ratify a massive massive agreement. That has happened and is actually entering into force. So this is completely unprecedented, like that something of this size has actually succeeded with so many ratifications. So this is very much a start of a new era. So all your qualms about the various issues in regards to PR and all that, whether these actual monumental obligations are actually monumental, that might prove to be wrong. You might find that a few years
I'll remain skeptical. But we'll see. Fingers crossed.
We'll have to keep our eyes on that.
The Pulse. The news that matters to you.
Now we have a story from Lewis about BBC's controversial video.
Indeed, they've been embroiled in a real controversy regarding their coverage of Black History Month. I've got a article here from the Independent. BBC has been accused of unbelievable racism and perpetuating stupid stereotypes after releasing a video asking certain people whether it was true all black people liked chicken. They attached it to a tweet, but then deleted it after initial backlash, replaced with a tweet saying, "Black people and fried chicken, is there any truth in it?" In the video, one white man says in the clip that loads of black people I know love chicken. It's the stereotype, but it's true. Two white girls then go on to claim that black girls they know eat lots of chicken because apparently it makes your bum bigger. A black girl points out it's not the only food we eat, and another has pointed out that certain cartoons and films have played on that stereotype, but it's received humongous backlash in the Twitter sphere. One woman has tweeted that it was unbelievably racist. Why treat a racist stereotype like some kind of reasonable discussion point? What for? Another has said that it's repulsive. BBC Newsbeat was exploiting racist and dehumanising anti-black stereotypes to attract viewers. Others have suggested that there was a lack of diversity amongst the staff at Newsbeat that could have seen the inappropriateness of the tweet and of the message before they'd sent it out. The BBC had even misquoted some of the people in the clip. There was a part where a girl talks about the stigma surrounding the stereotype that black people only want to eat a certain chicken from a certain restaurant. Subtitles changed stigma to thing. The BBC themselves, they defended the clip by saying that these short films show young people from various backgrounds discussing their experiences of dealing with different stereotypes, which accompanies a wider documentary looking at racism in the UK. Others have defended as well. For example, Adil Ray, who writes and features in the BBC sitcom Citizen Khan. He said that how is it racist in any way to discuss a stereotype? Stereotypes that we as a society form from what we know. Others have also chipped in. For example, the comedian Lenny Henry spoke earlier this year about how the BBC was very, very white and called it an oppressive institution. He said he worked at the BBC for 35 years before he had a meeting with anybody that looked like him. He said also that people like him were cleaning the corridors, and that's not right. The BBC are missing their own targets. Their target for the black, Asian and ethnic minority employees is 14.12%, but they're only hitting 12%. So, obviously, this is dreadful. It's a massive miscalculation on behalf of the BBC Newsbeat team. But even though there was probably no malicious intent, is a discussion like this ever justified, especially in the public sphere?
I think the only discussion you can probably have about this is to say that you shouldn't have a discussion about it, and that it's just something which should be swept under the rug as a stereotype, which is wrong and all that, and should just be ignored, really. I think BBC, in because they've got, if you think about the spread and the reach that BBC has and the amount of people, I mean, I know Newsbeat's supposed to be kind of a little light-hearted program or sector, but think about like how many people that can reach. The idea that they're bringing this up and almost legitimizing it, like making it a topic of discussion, I don't think that's right at all.
No, I'm quite shocked at people actually defending the BBC. I thought everyone would be against it. I'm quite shocked that actually people have defended this, and I'd love to hear their reasoning for it. I don't agree with it. I think it's wrong. I think they could have picked a more pressing topic, because the series of shows that is called Black Feeling or something, how people from black ethnicities feel in the UK, I think, was the title. And for them to bring out this stereotype and presume, you know, that people are going to want to talk about it, I just don't see the thinking behind that.
No, I completely agree. I think it's awful. And I think one of the most shocking things for me as well is that the BBC even managed to, or even allowed to produce this for it to be seen, because I'd have thought with all like the censorship and everything for something this controversial, which so many people have said isn't right, that it even got to that stage, I find a bit weird, really.
I mean, this has had a lot of backlash, justifiably. The original tweet got taken down, and it's been put back up with the new tweet which with the caption I said before. But the fact is they haven't taken it down. So what does that say about the editorial staff? So, I mean, there's a tweet in there that said, for example, if I can just find it, it was... the entire Newsbeat episode yesterday tells me, A, there are no black people working on Newsbeat, or B, they were outvoted. I just don't get how that ever could have passed the editorial stage. It's just crass.
I mean, to play devil's advocate slightly there, just because that statement that people, that there were no black people on the team or that they were outvoted, doesn't necessarily mean... that's not what happened. That might not have been what happened. It might have been that people did agree with it, and obviously it's gone through a number of different people to get through that, surely through some kind of quality control or ethics regulation or oversight. So clearly it did go through a lot of people, and none of those people had a problem with it. So
yeah, well, that's true, but then they saw the outrage from it being publicised and didn't take it down. They refused to take it down. And I think if you get that sort of response back from a programme that you've put out, you would consider taking it down, not just removing a tweet and then retweeting it afterwards.
I mean, does this episode that we have here, does this underline the calls in society still that we greatly struggle with racism in the UK? Would you say that this is symptomatic of a much bigger problem with racism we have in this country?
I mean, I guess that could be a documentary in itself, that right there. I guess so. I guess maybe that we struggle to talk. You could spin it and say maybe we struggle to talk about stereotypes because we think, oh, this must be racist or whatever. Maybe you can spin it that way, but no, I think I'd rather have them ask, do you feel like there is any racial stereotypes in the UK, phrase it that way rather than put it the way they did.
I can't understand BBC putting up this video in the first place, because BBC has a history of being called, I think it was hideously white in the early 2000s, and institutionally racist. And I don't really understand what was the point of this video. They weren't trying to challenge a racial stereotype. Why put it up there?
Yeah, I completely agree with that, actually. I think, but I do think that the BBC are trying, because they have obviously set out this whole series of videos that are meant to be empathising, is that the right word, with people from the black ethnicity groups.
They're just trying to widen the voice of that minority, essentially,
exactly.
Just to everybody understand.
I feel like the BBC should have probably responded better to the Twitter remarks.
This is URN The Pulse.
We have a story about care homes banning relatives who complain from Emma.
Thank you. So it has been known now for some time that care homes don't always offer the best quality of care. And today it has started to come to light that hundreds of care homes are banning relatives from visiting elderly residents over complaints about the quality of care. So Paul Doolan, for example, complained to his father's care home about the quality of care provided, including the care home not always ensuring that his father, Terry, was wearing his hearing aids. And following the complaint, Paul received an email from the care home asking him to stop his visits. And now Paul can only visit his father in a restaurant setting with a chaperone, a situation which Paul understandably describes as deeply upsetting. The care home, however, accused Paul of demonstrating unreasonable behaviour towards the staff, which Paul completely disputes. Perhaps an even worse situation can be seen with Carina Eastman, who has Alzheimer's disease, and when her children complained over the care home's inability to treat a cut on her leg and aggressive neighbours who've moved into the care home, Carina was given notice to leave the care home within 28 days and now resides in a different home. The care home responded by saying that the care home has the duty to accommodate each patient's needs accordingly, and when they can't accommodate them, it's their duty of care to allow them to relocate to another service of care. And moreover, an anonymous worker from the care home described the Eastmans as the relatives from hell. So, what do you think of the situation? How are we ever going to regulate the care industry when it's really just the care home's word against the relatives' word?
I feel like the gentleman case, I think he should have gone to, after the email, he should have gone to a higher body. There should be some form of higher body, I don't know if there is, but there should be a higher form of body that he can go to and report this care home. They should not be banning relatives for making a complaint.
No, I completely agree. I don't think the care home has any right whatsoever to be able to ban the relatives from visiting the residents. I think it's awful.
Yeah, it's not just about rights, but whether they can or not. It's about the idea that they're literally preventing people from seeing their relatives in the, unfortunately, last few years of their life. And it just, I don't really see how people can live with doing that. You must be quite removed or from the situation, like emotionally.
Yeah, I don't understand why the care home have the right to. I work at, as a caregiver, we do door-to-door caring. It's not in a care home, it's in people's houses. And we've been taught during training that it's the relatives, what they say goes. Even if you don't agree with what they're doing to your client, you can suggest things to them, but you can't stop them from maybe putting them in a care home or, you know, telling them that they need to do something or whatever. So the relatives have power over us. So I don't understand why the care home seems to think that it has power over the relatives.
I mean, we're looking at this at the moment from the care worker's point of view and from the relative's point of view. But actually, if we look at it from the person that's inside the residential or care home's point of view, it's distressing and disorientating enough to have to completely change setting, especially to those with dementia, like the ones you mentioned. So I think it's absolutely despicable. I mean, the care home, I think, should have the right to limit relatives' visits if they are being abusive and they can prove it. But in this case, I think it's absolutely horrible for the people involved.
So how do you think we can ever improve the situation, and what do you think we can do?
Well, there needs to be a little bit more transparency, because it is just the relatives' word against the care homes word. There needs to be a transparency. There needs to be some sort, either there needs to be a process, a legal process, where these sorts of things can be treated fairly. In, I don't know if there is a watchdog for this sort of thing, but if there isn't, then there should be, or there should be more support given to relatives that have been subject to these sorts of bans from seeing their own family, which just, it's just, no. No.
No, I've just remembered as you were talking about it, actually, that there is a governing body of such that goes around care homes and institutions like I'm part of, and does check them, but it's not that regular. It's like a governing body, a bit like Ofsted. Mm-hmm. So you kind of get warning when they're coming, so you can completely, and they don't check through emails or anything like that, if, for example, correspondence with relatives. So that is quite a puzzling thing to get round, how you'd be able to do that. I'm sure maybe he could complain to this company. I can't remember the actual name of the body, but and then they'd have to inspect, but I'm sure it's not that easy to prove if they just delete the emails.
It's just baffling why. I mean, obviously they weren't happy that the relative had a criticism of how the care home was run.
Mm.
But I'd be scared of having the negative publicity that this is bound to
It's created
throw
already.
Up. Exactly. And B, I don't know how they can live with it on a moral issue, just because, as we've already discussed, this is potentially, unfortunately, the last few years of their life, and their main purpose is to make sure that they're comfortable, make sure that they're happy and content in their environment as best they can, and provide as much support as they can. And here it just seems to be completely contravening all of the core values they should be standing for.
So do you think care homes is a good system inherently? Like, would you yourselves want to end up in a care home? I mean, I know for a fact that I've most of my friends who have worked in care homes, and myself included, I don't think I'd want to end up in one. I think I'd much rather, one of the ladies that I spoke to actually suggested living on a cruise ship the rest of her life, because it costs about the same and you get waited on hand and foot, and I quite like that idea. But would you guys think it's a good way to...
I think with all the kind of the negative press about care homes at the moment, it's certainly not. And for example, keep looking at this story again, by simply banning the relatives rather than thinking of ways to combat the problems and deal with the complaints, kind of just shows a complete reluctance of the care homes to care for the residents. So therefore, no, I don't think I'd personally want to end up in one.
I think the unfortunate issue about this is that we aren't going to have much of a choice. The reason that these people are able to do this and not perhaps suffer too much from the negative publicity is because it's quite inelastic, like the demand for these kind of places. The whole point of why people send their relatives to these care homes is because they can't do anything else with them, and it's unfortunate. Of course, we'd all love to be cared for all our life by people who love us, but... And today, that won't be the case for the vast majority of us. Well, not the vast majority of us, but definitely a significant number. So maybe, yes, increased regulation by... It's called the Care Quality Commission. I've just Googled that.
There you go. Yeah, I remember it now.
Increased regulation by them. Maybe that's what we want. But I mean, increased regulation, increased red tape, that brings a whole host of other problems, which people are bound to have so many more complaints about. And yes, it would be nice if everyone had excellent quality of life, especially in the end of their days, for whatever unfortunate reason. But there are probably other priorities, and it's unfortunate. But at the end of the day, all that's really happened here is that relatives aren't able to... They've been banned by complaining. That's not implying that they're having that the people in there are having a terrible time. That's just that the... relatives have been banned because they complained. And yeah, I reckon, unfortunately, as much as we can say we want to do we want to change the system and change the world, we probably can't.
That's very unfortunate.
This is URN The Pulse.
I've got a story from me about Bono winning Woman of the Year. The singer Bono has been recognised for his work on the Poverty is Sexist campaign this week with an award from Glamour. He has become the first Man of the Year at the Glamour Woman of the Year Awards. The campaign, Poverty is Sexist, aims to relieve the poverty which discriminates against women on a global scale. The magazine justified their decision to include a man for the first time in 27 years on their website, where they stated that when a major male rock star who could do anything at all with his life decides to focus on the rights of women and girls worldwide, well, all that's worth celebrating. The Irish singer was surprised by the honour, stating, "I'm sure I don't deserve it, but I'm grateful for this award as a chance to say the battle for gender equality can't be won unless men lead it along with women. We're largely responsible for the problems, so we have to be involved in the solutions." Despite his commitment to gender equality, some women were disappointed that an awards scheme that was set up to recognise the achievements of women in a world where they are often overlooked was being extended to men. Comments on Twitter such as, "Bono won Woman of the Year and Wonder Woman is a UN ambassador. If only there were real live human women to celebrate," encapsulated this disappointment. Do you think the awards should only stick to women, guys?
I mean, it's a bit of a thorny issue. I mean, I love the sentiment behind it, and I think it sort of carries on from what Emma Watson was saying in the United Nations about how men's rights are human rights. Mm-hmm. So being part of the struggle or the fight to ensure gender equality needs men as well as women. And I think it's great that it's being recognised, that Bono's contribution to gender equality has been recognised. I can sympathise with the people, though, that do feel as though it's an award scheme that was specifically set up to celebrate global female achievement in the world.
Yeah.
Is suddenly going to a man. I mean, for me personally, I think it was a little bit misjudged. Maybe it could have been an honorary award or another award, a second award. I don't know. But for a set of awards that were specifically made to celebrate the achievement of women across the world, the things that have been achieved, where so many world prizes are dominated by male winners, it just seems a little bit not so well thought about.
I feel like it's come at a pressing time as well, with the whole controversy about Wonder Woman being the UN ambassador, and that she doesn't encapsulate, you know, strong women, and she's only a cartoon, whereas there's a lot more women out there who could represent, be a UN ambassador, who people can connect with more because they're real. I feel like with that pressing issue, for Glamour to then come out with this is a bit of bad timing, because there is a lot of controversy in the air about awards. For example, my lecturer actually tweeted, Peter Stockwell, "If Dylan can get the Nobel for Literature and Bono is a Woman of the Year, I like to be considered for Crufts." I mean, the humour there, but I think it has come at this time where, I mean, the awards just seem to be throwing out to random people, and with the whole representation thing of the UN as well, I think people are up in arms at the moment. It just came at the wrong time.
I mean, well, part of the issue is that these awards and whatever, they're very much not making light of it in a bad way or in a obviously in a controversial way, but not in a negative, deliberately negative way. They're trying to make it more appealing to the wider audience. But the fact remains that this is actually a very, very serious topic. Women's rights across the world are not as good as men's rights, and that's just the fact. I mean, I'm sure people can go on and on and on about it, and I'm more than happy to listen to that. And they're right, you know. These things are quite serious matters, and by doing things like this, by kind of joking around or making it not as serious as it could be, perhaps that detracts a little bit from the message of feminism.
Jazz, what do you think? As fellow women.
I mean, it's not something I'm personally offended by. I know some women, some very, very strong feminists have maybe been slightly offended by it, and it's not something I'm offended by. I think it's a lovely sentiment behind it. I think he's done very, very good work. But I guess, as Lewis was saying before, I feel like maybe there could have been another award created for him, or he could have been given another award to recognise his work. But it's not something I think is a huge controversy personally. That would be my opinion on it.
We are going to talk about car insurance and Facebook posts now from Becky.
Okay, thank you. Yes, this is the news that car insurance provider Admiral has started a new campaign where it wishes to monitor Facebook posts in order to determine how much car insurance customers should pay. By looking at Facebook posts, and this is just posts, it's not including photos or anything, the insurance providers believe that they can get a good idea of someone's personality and thus their driving. For example, frequently using exclamation marks apparently conveys an overconfident and erratic personality, and so Admiral believes that quality of the driving would be poorer. The use of the words always or never also counts against people, as it apparently conveys overconfidence or arrogance. Conversely, writing in short, concise sentences and agreeing to meet people at a certain time rather than more ambiguous arrangements leads to less car insurance as you seem more organised. This is a scheme for first-time drivers, although it's not limited to them, and it's called First Car Quote. It is entirely voluntary, and if you agree to take part in this initiative, you can get discounts up to 5 to 15%, which is about £350 a year. However, Facebook has responded to the idea of this story, calling it inappropriate and a breach of privacy, so it's refused to allow the insurers access to posts. So the scheme has been delayed. Do we think this is a good idea? I mean, online I may seem organised, but I'm a terrible driver. So
can I just say, that comment by Facebook, that's so rich, that like they're that comment about privacy. Facebook takes so much data from us. They harvest so much. Like, they bought WhatsApp recently, and they've been taking that. They use it to like customise all our stuff. And it's just ridiculous, like, the amount of information which you put on Facebook and that they subsequently have. So I think it's absolutely insane that they would even comment that that's an invasion of privacy. I don't understand that at all.
I do, going back to the car insurance, though.
Sorry.
I mean, I don't... Sorry, right, don't worry. It's a valid point. But no, I feel like, how can they... What is the correlation between exclamation marks and good driving? I don't... Or bad driving, even. I just don't see it. Do you, Emma?
No, I don't see it at all.
I saw your face when it was mentioned.
Well,
when
Becky was reading it, I just thought it was the weirdest thing ever for such a big car insurance provider. You know, everyone has heard of Admiral, it's a really big company, to actually be able to suggest that as a serious suggestion just baffles me, really, to be honest.
I mean, I kind of want to sign up now just to find out whether I'm a good driver according to my Facebook post.
But surely people can monitor their posts and delete their so-called erratic and overconfident posts of exclamation marks and just write sensible stuff, but so they can keep a car insurance.
It's so arbitrary, like the amount of exclamation marks amounting to how good a driver you are. I mean, I'm not the biggest user of exclamation marks, so I must be an all right driver. I can't even drive. So, like, I don't see how it doesn't seem scientific, or if it is scientific, they're using completely the wrong method of going about it. But, I mean, even aside from the privacy thing, I mean, I guess they do have to give their consent. But to give a quote to somebody based on how they interact with people outside of a car makes no sense about how to insure somebody based on what they do in a car.
It makes no sense at all. And linking to Stefan's earlier little rant about Facebook, do we think that this actually is a breach of privacy? I mean, the scheme is voluntary, so people choose to sign up. Is it really up to Facebook to...
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I want anybody scrolling down my Facebook feed to find out my really old posts. They're horrendously embarrassing. I mean, depends how far they go. Like, if they go back to year 7, I'm going to have a lot of erratic posts. But recently, I'll be okay with. So it kind of depends, really, for me, personally.
I mean, it's not really an invasion, is it? I mean, I think Facebook, to use that phrase, is just kind of hiding some ulterior motive, just not wanting to start this as a kind of tactic that companies use. But I mean, I'm already worried enough about businesses and future employers looking through my Facebook, so I've already, you know, I've already culled all my hideous posts. But every time they pop up on this day, now they're gone.
So you'll get quite good car insurance by the sounds of it, then.
I mean, I haven't driven in 3 years, so I'm also probably a terrible driver.
But what is your exclamation use? What is your exclamation ratio?
3+ status, so I'm gone.
The Pulse. The news that matters to you.